It's my pleasure to introduce to you Teresa Herzfeld here and Mavis Ndonelli, who are panelists this evening. The topic is personal reflection on the African and Afro-American dialogue. Mavis will start.
Well, as you know, I'm Mavis, but I have my African name. I am Nomthanda Zo, and it means the one who prays. But I have been too busy here at Holden that I have not been able to pray that much. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well, I was born in South Africa and grew up there until I reached adult age. I was born of a low-income family, and we were four in that family, four of us, two boys and two girls. Well, what I'd like to tell you about my way, the way I grew up, is about how I was treated as a child. Because when I came to America, the first thing I noticed is that children here are treated differently as we were treated back home. So the first thing I remember about my own parents is that they were very strict on me. Like, for instance, I was expected to be clean all the time. If I had put on a dress in the morning, I'm expected that by the afternoon to be clean. Well, I didn't understand why. And again, I was not free. I couldn't move around with other kids. So that when I started school, I met other children for the first time, and I wanted to make friends with those kids, but it was still, say, less practical, because I would be with them in school, but the moment I get home, I'm in the house. Well, I didn't understand all this, but at times I would say, maybe these are not my parents. But I was made to understand the reasons for all those things. You think of a small thing of being tidy, clean all the time. Why my parents did that was because, in the first place, of poverty. You know that when the clothes get dirty, they should be washed. And there are instances where even to get that soap to wash the clothes is a hazard. And again, those clothes are expected to remain with me for a couple of months, so that the one who comes after me may still use them. Now, because my parents didn't want me to be with other children, I grew up as an inactive child, just going on by myself. And again, I have an explanation for that. In the whole African society, the most important thing is respect and morals. Now, my parents wanted me to have this respect to be successful in life. And again, I was expected to have a good moral. to be a good child. Because if I'm not a good child, I may not listen to anybody. Whereas it is understood that my success in life will be through listening to adults, doing what I'm told to do. Because if I don't do what I'm told to do, I won't be successful. Take this example. When I started school, my teachers were just as strict as my parents. And back there home, we are whipped at school. We are under discipline all the time. And I was made to understand that all they did to me was for my own good. Because if I was an undisciplined child, I would not gain anything at school. And if I didn't gain at school, it would mean no success. We have a problem at home that if a child doesn't do well at school, that child can do the same class 4 or 5 times. It doesn't matter. You only go to the next class if you work hard and listen. So now, from a poor family, the child is expected to be attentive, to listen to adults and do what that child is told. Because now my parents could not afford me repeating grades. Because even in that repeating grade, it means paying money for the same class, buying books for the same class, buying school uniform for the same class. So now they wanted progress, and that kind of progress was enforced by a whip. Fortunately, I was able to go on and on with all my grades, not repeating any grades, listening to my parents. I tried not to go against their rules. I tried very hard, and it hurt. So when I finished secondary level school, I went to college to train as a teacher. There was not anything else I could do. I didn't have a wide choice of what to do. Being a teacher was the cheapest I could afford, so I went to train. Well, I worked there as a teacher. I think I made a good teacher in Africa, but I think I can't teach here for some reason. Yeah. Then I went on until I got married, and then after that I had to look after my family. There's a problem again at home that once a woman is married in the teaching profession, that woman has to stop working. In other words, they used to take single women in the profession. Once you get married, they are cut off from duty. So I had to leave school and stay with my husband and bring up children. Since my husband was going to be a pastor, I know what was lying ahead of me. After a couple of years, when he finished, we went to a congregation. That is where I had a tough time dealing with adults now. Adults were not like children. I could teach children, but I couldn't talk to adults. But then I was faced with that work as a pastor's wife. In our church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in South Africa, if you are a pastor's wife, you automatically do all the duties from the church. You are a leader in the church. You hold conferences for the women and do Bible studies. So I had to do all that. But by that time, I had to go back to teaching. I was fortunate to get a post again. So now there was a conflict. The conflict is that, am I a pastor's wife or am I a working woman? I had to split myself between the two, which meant if in the morning I was in school teaching and it was a Thursday, I had to get in my uniform after school and join the women. Whether I liked it or not, whether it was standard or not. Because now, if I fail to do that, it would mean that I stop my job at school because I'm failing to serve both ends. So I stayed with that, going to school, working with the women, expected to do everything, to lead. At that time I had my children, three of them, and I brought them to America. So the family is here. I had hoped that I would bring up my children the way I was brought up. But seemingly it doesn't work. Yeah. My mom used to tell me that, listen to me. This is how I was brought up. So now I think it will be a recurring theme. When I came to America, I didn't know what to do with my kids because now they wanted that and that to do this and that. But I thought to myself, I just should let them go, be American. Well, I thought, I had a stereotype that, well, America is a country where the kids do whatever they like. Until I met a first friend, a lady of my age, who told me that her parents were strict with her when she was young. And again, I met my friend, Tressa. I was taken aback when Shafa told me how she was brought up. So now I know that whatever is happening here in America, whether the parents are permissive or not, it is something, I'm sure it's something that happens within families. It's not a society thing. So now I've seen the differences, the way people bring up their kids. And I'm hoping that when I go home, somewhere I have to go back and apply some other methods so that my own kids can fit in the society back home. And it won't be easy, I know that. I think that's all I can say for now.
When Will left, he told me not to talk about money, love, sex, or power. So that gives me. I think so. I too am from a poor family. My father was a mill worker in Kannapolis, North Carolina. And he only had sixth grade education level. And about the only thing he could do would be the menial job. My mother was a very strict woman. In every way, she was always the strong one in the family. Because it was almost a given in this society that she could get a job much faster than my father could, because she was a woman. And my mother told me that I don't want you being like other girls. Nothing good happens after 12 o'clock at night. And I want you in here before 10. And that applied even through high school. Because all of the other girls were going to the prom and I had to be in before 10. And I thought that was cruel. I just couldn't understand why. My mother has always been a Lutheran. My father has always been a Lutheran. When the missionaries came to the South, it was very difficult to get the Indians to become Lutheran or change their culture. It was much easier to convert the black people because they were deeply religious at that point. I entered school, an all-black school at that time, and the standard there was that you had to be better than white people in order to get a job. You had to work twice as hard. And you were punished at school by the teacher, by the principal, and after you got home. And I really thought that was so uncruel because everybody just seemed to be having fun. The white school was about, you could see the white school from the black school. And they seemed to be having so much fun, and seemingly we were still in a prison type situation. I was telling Mavis earlier that we had a dentist to visit the school twice a year because a lot of us could not afford private dentist. And this dentist would come twice a year. And now when you have one filling or two, then the dentist would tell you to come back and make another appointment. With the kids at the school, if you had four or five or six cavities, they would fill them all at one time. It was like it was no mercy given, like, I mean, these kids can take it. I'll see them in 6 months. I'll do all I can, you know, for them at that time. There was no coaching and no psychology about how nice it was going to be. I got a scholarship to attend an all-girls finishing school. And I offered teaching and nursing and etiquette, how to handle yourself in public. And then it was other courses offered, but that was the finishing part. And for the summer, I had to work during the summer to support my education. And during that summer, I met Will. He was doing his vicarage, and I happened to go to his church one Sunday, just visiting, and he was preaching that Sunday. And as I was going out of church, he held my hand and didn't let it go. And I was standing there in line doing this, you know, and everybody was coming by and greeting me as if I was a part of this. And I had no idea about being married to a minister. So when I went home for the summer, then it so happened that our church had a vacancy. And guess who was called? Will. And I happened to be the church organist and the secretary at the time. So there was no way that I could get away from Will. So during that summer, he always said that he was very cool and he was business. And after he finished his vacancy pastoring, but then that following September, then he said it was serious business. So we had an engagement of about two years. And and the talk after Will had graduated from the seminary, and one of the instructors were concerned that Will had gotten engaged. And pastors were not supposed to get engaged until after they had gotten into a parish. And so he called us in, and he was telling Will, all about what he should do and how he should be, how he should act, and that he had a choice to go to Alabama or to Rhodesia in Africa, and that he had a choice. And they assumed that if the black pastors made it in Alabama, which was called a training ground or a tough ground, that he could make it anywhere. So they compared Southern Africa with the Southern part. So Will said we would go to Alabama. We were in a parish for 5 years in Alabama, and that was during the Civil Rights Movement. Martin Luther King was very strong during that time, but he was banned from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And it was the time when Authorine Lucy had stood in the doors there at the University of Alabama. So it was state troopers everywhere, and the town was under close guard. And during that time, mass rallies were being held in support. At that time, we were still riding on the back of the buses. Some of the students at the black colleges were really upset about that. So they would protest and call meetings to get out these feelings. So, and Will was working strongly with Martin Luther King, so that evening, I was pregnant with Marty, and I got this telephone call saying, if you value your life, you better get out of town. And I was saying, well, what is this? Because I didn't know I was in the house pregnant and doing what I was supposed to do as a pastor's wife, supposedly, because it was roles then as to what you're supposed to do. And I couldn't understand that kind of hate coming over the telephone. I'd always seen it from a distance growing up, but never really close up. And then that evening, the calls just really got very strong. So we just took the receiver off of the hook. Mm-hmm. And when Will came in, he was fussing, why y'all got this receiver off the hook? And so I said, well, you just put the, you know, just put the receiver on the hook. And when as soon as he put the phone down, the phone did ring, and this call came in, and some of the most obscene language I had ever heard. The people in the neighborhood got uptight. And this was mainly a black community. They wanted to petition us out of town because we were causing trouble. And they didn't want any problems with the white folks, and they had jobs, and they just didn't want Will coming in town stirring up all this trouble. So they held a big mass meeting. Martin Luther King came to speak, and Dick Gregory came down. And it was really a big mass movement. That evening, tensions were very high because they had scheduled a march for the following day. The people had all gathered at this church. Outside of the church was a ring of policemen. Outside of the ring of policemen were a group of Klan. They did not guarantee safety outside of the police ring. We had a permit. It still hurts, okay. We had a permit to demonstrate. So as the people were coming out of the church, and a lot of the older women could not march, but they would come in and make sandwiches. So as the people were coming out of the church, then the police shot in tear gas and water hose. I don't know how many of you have experienced tear gas, but it burns and it's nauseating. And it's almost blinding. So when you come out of a situation or people still trapped in a building, you knock out windows and anything you can to get air. So when the police was coming in to stop this, because first of all the leaders came out. It was Will and it was a few other leaders in town. So they were the first ones arrested. So that means that when the leaders were taken, then the people were like sheep. They didn't know what to do, you know, at that point. So They and people were coming out of the windows trying to run out and staggering for air. They were beaten, and when they got inside, they beat the old ladies that were there because they happened to be a part of what was going on, and they supported it. Any white person that was caught in this, they were taken out and made examples of. They were really beaten brutally in jail. And it was one student, I won't forget him at all. All he had, he came from the north, and all he had on his back was what he had, and he had his toothbrush and his comb and everything in his pocket. Well, after a couple of days after them being jailed, he came back by a house, and you could see all these knots and rolls all on his neck and all the bruises on his body. It wasn't anything that could be done about it because they would say that he fell down the steps or something else happened to him. And when I saw how the people were beaten and the look on their faces as if these people are out of line, they're out of place. And that really did strike me real, I just couldn't believe by being a Christian and the other people being so-called Christians could treat one another that way. So after a while, that went on and things settled down and the Civil Rights Act was passed. But still the pain of what had happened. One of the members in our church was a taxi driver. So he was the one that would bring people to the masses and take people back. And he said, I don't want to get involved in any of this mess because I don't want to get hurt. I have my home here. By him driving around taking up people, he was the first one to be stopped by the police. And they almost beat his brains out. And when he came back to our house, he says, I'm black and I'm a part of this. It doesn't matter. I cannot escape. No kind of way. I could not tell them I was not involved. I was black. And I was already involved in it. Through some of I call the saving graces of some of the white supporters that came in and took a strong stand, really did help the movement, and it did create a sense of balance in what was happening. We one other instance of injustice is that being in a segregated hospital, you get the used equipment, the equipment that doesn't work that well, whatever is left over. And I was pregnant at the time and I had an early pregnancy. The child would have lived, but it was put into an incubator that did not have a heat regulator. So naturally it cooked and burned the child. So see, those still hurt, you know, and you know why it happens. We drove up to a service station and a black boy came out to put gas in our car. And the white owner said, we ain't got no gas here. We had to drive 45 miles. And I don't know how we got to where we were going, but somehow we got to Will's grandmother's house. I don't know, on an empty tank of gas. I don't believe it. And they were so quick to work with you, you know, until they took no time with you. You know, only thing, they just wanted to get you in there and get you out. And that whole cycle of things going on. We left Alabama. And we came to California. This was in we came to California in 1966. And Will was called as a part of a special ministry that worked with several churches. His first beat and assignment was to work on the streets. So he walked a lot and talked with prostitutes and alcoholics and which was an interesting ministry because seemingly those people were not accepted into a church. You know, they were downcast and the whole thing. But an interesting ministry developed from that.